Welcome again to 12 South. My name is Elliot. I'm the pastor here, and it's a joy to be with you this morning. Before we enter the sermon portion of our time together, I have a little update announcement. We've had a page-turning moment in the life of our church, and I want to talk to you about that page-turning moment, but really I want to talk to you about kind of the first couple paragraphs of the next page. Like, the chapter is ended, and now we're entering a new season, and I want to talk to you just a couple paragraphs about it. We, as of about a month ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we are officially under contract to own this building, which is great. It's amazing. But here's what that means. After a lot of waiting and hoping and praying, we are here. That chapter is turning. Here's kind of the first paragraphs on the next page. First is this. There is a committee of folks that has been gathering for the last couple of months. A vision and dreaming and prayer team asking the Lord that if and when we got this property and now we are getting it, Lord, how would you have us use this corner? What are your visions for this place? How would we use this building and these renovations to serve our people and serve our neighborhood and serve our city? What does it mean to be given such a gift, and how might we use that gift to serve our people and the neighborhood and the city? So there's a team that's been meeting, wonderful humans, some of my favorite people are in the room there. We are taking it very intentionally and very slow to prayerfully, thoughtfully dream about what it might look like. That work is picking up now that the building is officially ours, but here's one of the things that committee needs from you. A couple weeks ago, once the contract was official, that committee sent out a survey to you if you are a member, a volunteer of any kind, or if you made a pledge to the capital campaign a year and a half or so ago. So if you're in any of those categories, a member, a volunteer of any kind, or, and our staff got it too, but or a donor, pledger of the capital campaign, you got a survey. Here's what I know. It's been a couple weeks of spring break, and we found out from several people that survey went to their spam. Satan didn't want you to have it. But we really, that committee would love for you to please fill out that work. That's really important data for us to aggregate and pray through and think through as we hear from our most inner folks. So if you are on that list and didn't get that email, you can't find it, it's going to be resent out this Tuesday to our members, our volunteers, and our donors. So if you still don't have it by Tuesday or you can't find it, please let us know, because we would love for you to fill that out. It's really important work to please do that. So that's one. That's kind of the first paragraph of the next chapter. Here's the second paragraph of the next chapter. I was a math minor. I know that's shocking, but I'm not terrible with numbers. But here's where we sit on from a numbers perspective. We had pledged in our capital campaign, pledged to the campaign $9.5 million, which is amazing. The purchase price on the corner, because it's this church building and the house behind, this whole corner, is $10.8 million. You roll in some closing costs, it's around $11 million. So we have $9.5 pledged and $11 million of total cost to own the property. Let me get into some numbers real quick. We have of the $9.5 million, we have about a little over five of those pledges turned into cash. We would ask, please, and preferably the leaders of this church would say, please turn your pledge into cash ASAP. Because the more cash we have between now and when we actually close, the less debt we have to take on to make up that delta between the 9.5 that was pledged and the 11 million total cost. Now, here's the other invitation. If you weren't here for the campaign, we would love for you to join us to get us from 9.5 to 11. We would love to enter this season of owning this asset with no debt. And it is definitely possible if the Lord wants that. We're just inviting you into it. So there's kind of two asks in that. If you made a pledge, we're asking, would you please remember that you did that and please turn that into cash? It'd be huge, of all amounts, please. And then if you weren't around, that new delta between 9.5 and 11 would be huge. If we could get that other 1.5 covered, that'd be amazing. So that's the next paragraph. The next paragraph is this. In our governance and polity of our denomination, it's beautiful, but we cannot own this property until our members sign off on that. Some denominations, the denomination owns the property. That's not true. And in our denomination, the members own the church through the leadership of the church. That's how it's written. So we can't enter into owning this piece of property until our members vote on it. So if you're a member, We are having a member meeting, a congregational meeting, on Sunday, May 3rd. It's the first Sunday in May at 4 o'clock at Waverly Belmont. Down the street. It'll take the place of our 5 o'clock service. There will be worship that night, and so we'd love for you to come worship with us. Even if you come to a morning service that morning, please come to the 5 o'clock or the 4 o'clock congregational meeting down the street. Non-members are welcome. We will just take a member vote. We'll have time for Q&A that evening. You can certainly ask questions anytime before then, but that night we'll have some time set aside for that. So member meeting is huge for us. We cannot actually own the property until members vote off on that. So that will be the motion that night to do that. So that's it. The committee and the survey work, the pledging and the numbers work where we're at, and then the congregational meeting that's coming up. And I would love for us to now together have some Q&A time, but we're not going to do that. We're going to go to Jesus' Q&A time with someone in the book of John. Really exciting. This year, we're walking through the book of John, the life of Jesus, at kind of the pace of Jesus, which I love. It's very slow. We are walking, we will be, in most of 2026, we will be studying the life of Jesus in the book of John, looking at Jesus through this lens. He is the misunderstood Messiah. That seemingly everywhere where Jesus goes in John and the interactions Jesus has in John, he is remarkably rejected and misunderstood by everybody. Insiders and outsiders don't get what Jesus is trying to do. And what's interesting as you look at Jesus through the misunderstood Messiah lens is that here's as that diamond begins to rotate and you see different angles of the beauty of that, here's what you begin to realize is, what does it say to you about a Jesus who's willing to continue to be misunderstood by the people that he came to save? He was willing to be so misunderstood, it landed him on a cross. He was willing to do that, to continually be misunderstood and rejected to its ultimate end. What does that tell you about him? And so we're looking at all these interactions of people that don't fully understand Jesus, and they understand him a little bit more sometimes after the interaction or later on in their life, but we're studying these misunderstood Messiah moments all throughout the book of John. So we close out John chapter 4 today. We're going to read the last 11 or 12 verses in that section for this interaction with Jesus. Verse 43 says this, "After the 2 days he departed for Galilee, for Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his hometown." He was from Galilee, Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus of Galilee. He's up from up north. "So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him," kind of. They wanted him to do some stuff for him, "having seen all the miracles that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast. For they too had gone down to the feast." It was Passover. He was just in Jerusalem. "So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine." That was his first miracle a few chapters ago. "And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, the region, he went to Jesus and asked him to come down to Capernaum and heal his son, for he," the son, "was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, 'Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe.' The official said to him, 'Sir, come down before my child dies.' Jesus said to him, 'Go. Your son will live.' The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, 'Yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him.' The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, 'Your son will live,' and he himself believed and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee." It's the word of the Lord. Amen. What do you think Jesus should be doing for you right now? What do you think Jesus ought to be doing for you these days? Like, why won't you give me a spouse? Why won't you fix the spouse that I have? Why won't you let me not stress about money anymore? Why won't you take care of that? Why won't you rid me of my constant anxiety? Why won't you get rid of my addiction for me? You could do that. Why won't you let my wayward child come back home? Why won't you do these things? You should be doing these things, Jesus. See, we come to a story today with a man who is desperate for Jesus to do something for him. And one of the key markers of desperation in the human experience is that in our desperation, we make demands of other people when we're desperate. Not any less so true than when we come to Jesus when we're desperate. We make demands of him. A little context for where Jesus is and has been, kind of to set the scene for what's going on in this interaction, this very brief interaction. You can throw that map up there. So Jesus has been down at the south edge of this map. Is the map up there? There we go. I drew that map. No, I didn't. Jesus has been down in Judea, the southern part of Israel, in Jerusalem. It's the capital. He was down there for the Passover feast just a few chapters ago. And that's when he meets with Nicodemus in John chapter 3. Ben talked to us last week. He preached last week on chapter 4. Jesus leaves Jerusalem and heads north to go back up to Nazareth in Galilee, the region up north where he's from. And he passes through Samaria, that region in the middle. But Jews didn't do that. They usually went on the other side of the Jordan River and went up to get to the northern part of Israel because they despised the Samaritans. And so Jesus bucks all the, you know, cultural norms, and he goes through Samaria. That's where he meets the Samaritan woman at the well, has a wonderful interaction with her. And now he's on his way back up. It says he leaves and he heads back to Galilee, that region up top, to go to Nazareth, the region where he was from. And he actually goes to Cana. He's in Cana, a different city. That's where he turned the water to wine at the wedding. He most likely was at a family wedding then. So he's probably staying with or visiting some family in Cana. He's maybe visiting the newlyweds, you know, checking on them. How's it going? He's in Cana. Well, word spreads across this region up north that Jesus is back in the region. He's been down in Jerusalem. Word is starting to spread that he's got some magical powers. He can do some things. So this man that we meet, a royal official, that's what we're told about him. He lives in Capernaum, which is about 20 miles to the west up there on the Sea of Galilee. You see that up there? From Cana. Jesus is in Cana. This man's from Capernaum. So this man, it's a two-day journey uphill, both ways. No, uphill. He hikes from Capernaum to Cana on the rumor that Jesus is there and that Jesus can do something for him. That's the setting. Now, please understand what Jesus has just been through. He's walked for days from Jerusalem. All the hype, all the hustle, all the bustle. He's undergone the public confusion of even going through Samaria, the cultural hate of that. He gets back up to Nazareth. He's coming home for a little while. And he gets back to his home, to with his people, which he says reject him and don't understand him, and no prophet is accepted in his hometown. And he gets there, and someone comes knocking from Capernaum. This man has a dangerously ill son back at home, so he understandably was willing to go the two-day journey to meet Jesus in Cana, hiking up to Cana. And this is how, I just wanted you to see that context to kind of feel the setting of what we're about to walk through. Verse 47, this is how the interaction begins. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea, south, to Galilee, north, he went to him and asked him to come down, come hike back down these mountains with me, hike back down to Capernaum with me and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Now, it's a generally harmless opening interaction with Jesus. That where it says right there, he asked Jesus. It's a very common Greek phrase for when you're asking someone, it tends kind of to lean towards the begging side of things. You know, like, I really need you, Jesus, to come down. It sounds probably like a lot of our prayers sound if you're the praying type. Not too demanding. We would never want to, you know, sound too needy. Not too demanding. Seemingly humble on the front end of this ask. I need you to come down. Please come down. Please come down. Please come down. And there's got to be in this man what's in us, which when we come to Jesus in that way, needing him to do something, hey, Jesus, I kind of feel like this is kind of an easy ask. Because don't you want the same things that I want right now? Like, don't you want my son to live? Don't you want my anxiety to be gone? Don't you want my mom to be healed? Don't you want me to not be stressed? Aren't you and I on the same page, Jesus? I'm not asking for something so outside the realm of what I would think you would want. I'm asking you to do something, Jesus, that I know you can do that would not be that hard for you. And I think you kind of want it, don't you? Now, it's really, you need to know this, culturally, he wants him to come with him to Capernaum because ancient world, first century, lots of healings took place. Spiritual teachers, magicians, soothsayers, wisdom teachers, there were lots of healings in the ancient world on record. However, it was required, there's no record of healing from afar. You gotta be in the room with my son, Jesus, so I need you to come down to Capernaum right now. Can you come down to Capernaum and heal my son? I need you to be in his room. He's on his last breath. I need you to come down with me to heal my son. Verse 48, Jesus' first response. So Jesus said to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. Okay, Jesus, not what we're talking about, bro. Not what I'm interested in having a discussion with you about right now. That's not why I came to you. It's interesting, though, when Jesus says that, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. The you there is the plural you. It's like the y'all of Galilee. He's talking to the man, but he's rebuking the whole crowd. And here's what Jesus is acknowledging. He's acknowledging for this man and for everybody else early on in his ministry that Jesus knows the heart of mankind and he knows why we normally come to him. I just need you to fix my problems, Jesus. I just need you to do something for me that I know you can do, and I don't really know why you're not doing it yet. He's basically saying, I know that you are out there asking for this because you won't believe in me unless I work some miracle for you, which translation, let me translate that for you. What Jesus understands about that is he's going, you don't really want me. You want what I can do for you. You don't really want me. You don't want to be in a relationship with me. You don't want to know me. You just want my power to actually change what's good for you. And this man is exposing just how much he and we and they misunderstand the Messiah. Like when you and I come, when this man comes, first time this guy's met Jesus, by the way, when he comes, what and makes this ask, I need you to come with me back to Capernaum and heal my son. What do you think that says, at least in his desperation, what do you think that says about his framework for why Jesus came into the world to begin with? Jesus, you came to fix my life. You came to make my life easier. You came to do what I need you to do. You came to answer to me. So when we come to Jesus this way, what do you think it says about our understanding of him and why he exists? This is part of Jesus' rebuke of this man. Because people so often in crisis or desperation, when we come to him in that state, we're feeling the acuteness of our pain, we're feeling the acuteness of our stress, the acuteness of our abandonment and our desperation. When we're in that mode, we tend to come to him and it's a little egocentric. Because all we want to talk to him about is my problems. Just, can we talk about me for a little bit? It's my favorite subject. Like, I need you to think about me. I need you to think about my life. I need you to fix my problems and take care of my pain. Just make my pain go away. It shows what we think Jesus is all about. It shows our understanding of Jesus when we come to him that way. It's been said before, and it's not entirely untrue, that people in crisis, people in desperation are ripe to meet Jesus. And that's true, because Jesus only meets people at the end of their rope. That's where he lives. Right? That's true. However, sometimes people at the end of their rope are quite toxic. And it's understandable. You're in the vortex of a pain. You're in the vortex of a chaos that truly, like at the like brain wiring level, you might only be able to think about you and your pain in that moment and in that season. But sometimes when we can't see past our vortex of pain, our vortex of chaos, sometimes when we're in our current crisis, all we care about Jesus doing is fixing our life the way we want him to fix it. And a faith in Jesus or a relationship with Jesus that demands signs and wonders from him and lays down the parameters and the specifics of how those signs and wonders have to come to fruition, it is a subtle way of us putting God in our service. Like, hey, Jesus, I need you to do this for me and I need it to look this way, so you can get busy doing that. It puts God underneath us. And Christians and non-Christians do this all the time with our Maker. We do this all the time. We put him in our service. And so before we go any further in the story to see how Jesus continues to walk in this interaction, please hear on some levels what Jesus is trying to communicate initially. Jesus is gentle and lowly, but this is a blunt rebuke to start this interaction with this guy. But listen to at least part of what he's saying to this man. I don't have to answer to you. That is at least part of what he's saying. I didn't come to do your bidding. I know you want my power. I know you want me to fix things in your life. I know you want me to change things in your life. I just need you to know that I don't bow down to your demands of me. Especially, I don't bow down to the way in which I have to do what you want me to do. And so that's the rebuke from Jesus, verse 48. Look at how the official responds, verse 49. The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Now, if you're a parent, you can understand his intensity, but please know I didn't make up that intensity. That's actually in the grammar of the Greek New Testament, the original language. In the Greek grammar, that verb come down is in the imperative voice, which is the command voice. It's how masters talk to servants, is with the imperative. It's how God talks to his people, is in the imperative. He's commanding Jesus. That's what an imperative word and verb means. Jesus, you come right now to my house and do this. Like, hey, I need you to come down to Capernaum. Please, 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 please. You won't believe unless you see a sign and wonder. You come down now, dude. You come down to Capernaum right now. I'm telling you what to do now. Some of us in the room would be mortified to admit that that's how we talk to Jesus in our hearts sometimes. But all of us talk to Jesus that way. Even in your groaning and bitterness and complaining, we talk to Jesus this way. We talk with this tone and this tenor in our hearts toward Jesus all the time. You do this for me now. I'm not playing the like the niceties, I'm not playing the nominal Christianity thing. Like, we're done talking about what you want to rebuke me about. You do this for me now, Jesus. And why haven't you yet? And if we're honest with that place, if we'll let that place speak to us, that place that's in us that we can all get to, if you will pay attention to that place of what you are demanding and imperatively commanding Jesus to do for you in this season, if you will get to that place, if you'll listen to that place, here's what it will tell you. It will show you what you truly love, and it will show you what you're truly afraid of. Your demands will tell you what you're truly afraid of and what you truly love. Like this man, understandably, totally understandably, loves his boy, and he's terrified of losing him. But his demand of Jesus is directly connected to what he's afraid of and what he loves. Same thing's true for us. Your demands and your commands of Jesus will tell you what you're afraid of and will tell you what you love. Like if you're demanding Jesus to do something for you on any front, would you please have the courage to be honest enough, at least with yourself, that if you want him to fix your parents or fix your addiction or fix your spouse or fix whatever, fix your anxiety, whatever it is, if you are demanding that he fix it for you, would you at least listen to those demands long enough to know what they are revealing to you about you? And then if you'll keep going, I know I didn't give you very long there, but if you'll keep going and you'll keep listening to that place, here's what else your demands will show you. Because our demands of Jesus, our commands and our imperativeness with Jesus, they don't just show us what we're afraid of and what we're in love with, they show us where we need real healing. Because our demands and our commands of Jesus, they're merely like symptoms of, they're just like survival mechanisms. They're coping mechanisms for how we normally handle our pain and our sadness and our fear. Your demands will show you how you normally cope with your fear, how you normally cope with your sadness, how you normally cope with your pain. Demands expose the pain you're in, yes. They will also expose to you your normal MO. They will show you how you normally handle your pain, which is showing you the place that you need real healing from and real healing for. That's actually what needs to be healed, is the place that you've learned how to cope with your pain. Like, look at this official when he comes to Jesus and he demands imperatively, "You come down to Capernaum now, Jesus." What do you think that says about how this guy normally handles when he's in pain and when he's stressed out? This is a royal official. That's what the term actually is. This guy reports to Herod, the king. In a Roman-occupied country, this man has all kinds of power and all kinds of rule and all kinds of authority. When this man commands something, it happens. When this man says something, something happens. He's got servants. We find that out in just a few verses. He's got servants at his house. He's used to, when I feel the acuteness of my pain and my sadness, when I feel the acuteness of my stress and my anxiety, I just command things and they happen and all my pain goes away. I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to think about that. You guys do it and I don't have to do it anymore. So if Jesus, that's his coping mechanism. So if Jesus, if he had come to Jesus that way, what do you think would have happened and what would it have truly done for him if Jesus had acquiesced to his demands and his commands of him? Oh, let me come right with you, sire. Let me do whatever you're telling me to do right now. Do you think it would have healed his pride? Do you think it would have healed his coping mechanism of control and power if Jesus had just bowed down to his commands like everybody else does? Like, what if Jesus cares about him and his son? What if Jesus wants to do two healings? Let's look at how Jesus responds to the demand. You come with me right now and heal my son. Verse 50, Jesus said to him with his own imperative, go. Your son will live. How do you think that sat with the official? No, Jesus, I just told you to do something. Now you're telling me to do something? Jesus, I just told you to come with me. You're telling me now to go without you? Healings can't happen if you don't come with me. But is it possible that Jesus loved this man too much to bow down to his demands of him? Like, what if Jesus loves you too much to play into your demands of him? What if Jesus is so for you, he's so for your healing and healing you in a deep way, deep healing, that he's actually unwilling to let your desperation dictate what he does for you and how he does it? Is it possible that Jesus is a jealous lover and he so loves this man that he doesn't just want this man to want things from him, he wants this man to want him because Jesus wants him? It should be noted that after this man's demands and imperative command of Jesus, Jesus doesn't judge or condemn him. He doesn't judge or condemn us either when we come to him at the point of our need, even if it's exposing all these things in us. But here's what it does mean when we come to Jesus with our need. It does mean we may not get what we expected to get, and it certainly means we may not get what we expected to get in the way that we're expecting to get it. Like, is it possible that Jesus wants to change and transform our desperation and turn it into faith? And if that's true, it means that Jesus actually wants to turn your desperation and he actually wants to make you new. He wants to heal you. Jesus actually cares deeply about you, and because he cares deeply about you, he actually wants to transform you. He just isn't gonna be able to transform you if he's just doing everything you demand for him to do. And when Jesus sends this man back to Capernaum alone, it sends this man into a situation where this man has to, now the roles are reversed. This man now actually has to bow down to Jesus' words, and he has to walk in faith that Jesus is who he says he is. Please don't miss this. Jesus creates this crisis for this man. Jesus creates it. Not just to heal the son. That was done the moment he said, your son will live. Jesus creates a crisis for this man to heal the man. See, it's hard in like the pithiness of this story when it's like accordioned in and you like can't see it all. But if you unpack it a little bit, we're on the other side of it to know, oh yeah, this man's son was healed. He got home and they threw a party and everything was good. Go back into this story. Go back to the moment where this man goes, you come to Capernaum right now. And Jesus goes, no. Go. Your son will live. Do you know the moment that that man turns and then walks back to Capernaum for 20 miles in 2 days? He's on a desperate 20-mile walk of faith. He has to take a step of obedience and then thousands more steps of obedience in faith with nothing to hold on to except a promise of God. That's all he has. Like, please, I know it's hard to imagine when we're in the modern day. This man has no phone. He has no Twitter. He has no Snap. He has no fax machine. He has no way of communicating back home to know, hey, Jesus just said this. Did that happen? So when he walks from the interaction with Jesus back to Capernaum, guess what he has? He has zero confirmation. He has zero guarantee. He has zero evidence and zero certainty that what Jesus just said actually is true. So what does that mean he has to walk in for 2 days? Faith in a promise of God. That's all he has. And do you know that obeying Jesus in walking by faith in the promises he's made to you, do you know that living as if those promises are true, walking in the faith that those things are true, even when nothing about your circumstances would communicate to you that those promises are true, do you know that when you and I walk by faith in those promises and we obey him and we walk by faith in that way, guess what it does? It heals us. It actually transforms us when we do that. I hate that. I don't like the sound of that. No one likes the sound of that. But would you dare to believe, would you dare to consider that Jesus may know what you need more than you know what you need? Like, I know we all love to be our own counselor, our own advisor, and like we know what's best for us, and I am the king of me, so no one can tell me what's best for me except me. What if you're wrong? What if you don't know what's best for you? What if Jesus knows what's best for you? What if Jesus knows what will heal you and you don't? I saw an interview this week, a little clip from an interview this week with Bill Murray, the comedian, legend. And it was from an interview about 15 years ago for a movie he was doing, and he got asked this question, and he referred back to this story 30 or 40 years before that when he was just getting started in Chicago as a comedian and an actor. I think he was at Second City Improv Club, but he was just getting started. No one knew who he was. He had no success. He moved to Chicago, cashing all his chips, like, I'm going to try to make it as an actor, comedian guy, and he bombs one night. Didn't tell any details about the bombing, but he said, it was such a bad bombing, I was doubting every choice I'd ever made. And I was so depressed when I left the theater, I literally thought, like, my career's over. I don't recover from a night like that. I'm too new. No one knows if I'm good or not. Maybe I'm not cut out for this. Maybe I can't do this. And I've cashed in all my chips to do this, so there's nothing really to live for. So he said, I left the theater that night, and I decided in Chicago, I'm just going to kill myself. I'm going to go commit suicide. So he said, I'm just going to go get drunk enough, and I'll just walk to Lake Michigan, and I'll just fall in and not come up. That was my plan. And as he's walking, and I've been there, we've been to Chicago many times, my wife's from there, and he happens to walk by on his way to Lake Michigan, the Art Institute of Chicago, the art museum. And it's an amazing art museum. We've been, and he's like, maybe I'll just walk around in here until the street's clear enough so that it, like, no one will be around when it's dark enough and late enough, and then I can walk into the lake. And he said, I got in, and I was captivated by this painting, this piece. It was so beautiful that it woke me up out of my stupor, and it alarmed me that if beauty this beautiful is possible in the world, maybe I could get up another day. Maybe there is something to this life. Like, beauty saved him. But here's what was striking to me about that as it relates to this story is that Bill Murray didn't know what he needed that night. He thought he needed to kill himself. But he needed an encounter with beauty that he didn't even know he needed. But it saved his life. It actually healed him. And he wasn't even looking for it because he didn't know he needed it. Is it possible that there's an encounter with Jesus, an encounter with faith, an encounter with beauty that you need that you don't even know you need? And it could save your life. I know in your pain, and I know in your anger, I know in your fear that you think you know what you need from Jesus. You think you need answers from him, explanations from him, for him to do something for you, for him to do something in a certain way for you, for him to give you this promotion or give you this relationship or give you this freedom. You think you know what you need? And maybe you don't know what you need, but Jesus does. Is it possible that what you need more than any of those things is actually an encounter with beauty, which is named Jesus? And you need to walk by faith in him, in the road that he's laid out for you, believing in him, that that actually could heal you. Look, all faith is believing that Jesus is not a liar most of the day. Faith is taking Jesus at his word and believing he's not lied to me. He's told the truth. And faith is believing that Jesus is not a liar, especially when the only thing you may have to go on to believe that is some promise he's made to you. That nothing else about your life is telling you that Jesus is not a liar, but I'm going to choose to believe that he is telling the truth. I'm going to hang on to the promise, and I'm going to let the promise hold on to me. A few examples of this. Like, you may want Jesus to heal your loneliness. He has promised, he is, and he will heal that. He just may not heal it through a spouse. But he's promised to never leave you or forsake you. He's promised that the work he began in you, he will complete till the day of Christ Jesus. He's promised he will be with you to the end of the age. He's promised to never abandon you. So you want Jesus to heal your loneliness, and he's promised that he's with you. Walking in faith that Jesus is with you and is enough to be with you in your loneliness, walking that way even when it doesn't feel that way can actually heal you. It can heal the thing that you're so in pain over. Another one. You want Jesus to heal your fear of being provided for. He is and he will provide for you. It just may not come by him increasing your bank account the way that he wants, or the way that you want him to. He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. He promises to give you everything you need for life and godliness. He promises that those who put their trust in him will lack no good thing. He will take care of you. He has taken care of you, and he will continue to take care of you. It just may not come the way that you want it to come. And walking in faith of the promise of God that he will take care of you, walking as if that's true, even when it doesn't feel like that's true, walking in that promise can heal you. Faith in that promise can heal you. One more. You want Jesus to heal your addiction. He is and he will heal your addiction. It just may not come by him setting you free overnight and giving you the strength for the rest of your life today to where you never need him again when you face this addiction. But he's promised that his power is made perfect in weakness. He's promised that his grace is sufficient for you. And so if his power is made perfect in weakness, the way that he may heal you from your addiction is by signing you up for a life of weakness for the rest of your life. And walking in faith that his power is made perfect in weakness, and I may always have this limp, and I may always be in recovery, but my Jesus is with me, and my Jesus has promised that his grace is enough for me. Walking like that's true, guess what it can do? It can heal you from the place underneath your addiction. It can heal you from the very place that's causing your addiction. And this official, when he's presented with that choice to walk in faith in the promise of Jesus when I have no evidence to believe if it's true, he does. Shockingly, he does. Verse 50, second half of verse 50. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. He leaves with nothing but a promise to hold on to. He drops his original demands with Jesus. You come with me to Capernaum. He drops all that, lays that down, and he walks in and by faith in the promises of God. Now, please understand this. Jesus didn't need this man's faith to heal the son, right? The servants confirm that later when they go, well, he goes, what time did he heal? Oh, the moment Jesus said he was going to be healed. So Jesus wasn't like, well, your son will be healed if you do good on this little test. No, your son's gonna live healed. Jesus didn't need this man's faith in order to heal the son. This man needed to walk in faith to be healed himself. Because what Jesus knows is that life-giving, truly healing and transformative faith grows beautiful and pure in the same place where gold grows beautiful and pure. You know where that is? In a furnace. And Jesus, the misunderstood Messiah in this text, is making this man's life hard for him. Jesus is doing that. Jesus sends this man into a furnace for 2 days. That must have been the longest walk the man had ever been on in his life. Like, this man wants Jesus to come with him. Do you realize, like, Jesus coming with him would reassure him on the road? Do you realize Jesus going with him means, like, oh, you're coming to the house because healings happen in person and, oh, you can do that now? Jesus going with him would have reassured this man, sure, I'll come with you, buddy. Let me hold your hand. Let me walk with you. Do you realize how much confidence and faith in Jesus this man would have seemingly had if Jesus walked with him? But Jesus doesn't go. Jesus could have lightened this man's load, taken burden off of him and walked those 2 days with him and said, I'll come with you and I'll reassure you all along the way that I'm going to heal your son and I'm coming with you. It's going to be okay. We got time. All those things. But Jesus does none of that. He just says, go. Like, what if Jesus knew what this man needed more than this man knew? What if Jesus knows when you need reassurance sometimes, which he could have easily done here? And what if Jesus knows when you need to take an incredibly long and gut-wrenching walk by faith for you? Jesus creates this scenario for this man. Jesus sends him on this road, where the only thing this man is going to have to cling to on his first step and his 20,000th step, and when he's trying to fall asleep that first night, and when he's waking up and he's not sure, am I crazy? Why didn't I make Jesus come with me? This is insane. The only thing this man has to cling to in all those dark nights of the soul, the only thing is a promise that Jesus made. Because Jesus knows that life-giving, truly healing and transformative faith grows and becomes more beautiful and pure where gold grows beautiful and more pure is in the furnace. So if that's true, why would you ever trust a Jesus like that, that sends people into the furnace to walk by faith in his promises? Why would you ever walk through a furnace by faith in a God like this? Well, when this man gets home, you can imagine the scene. Servants confirm, oh, Jesus, the moment Jesus said it, he was healed. Here's what this man was able to then realize. That dude, Jesus, actually loved us. I wondered it the whole way home. I didn't know if it was true or not. That man cared for us. He cared for my family. He loved us enough to save my son. Him believing Jesus actually loved him transformed him. And it says him and his whole house believed. His faith grew. He already believed. He walked away by faith. He took Jesus at his word, but now he believes even more. His faith grew through the furnace. And on the other side of the furnace, guess what? He believed even more. Jesus actually did love me. And here's what's crazy. That you and I growing in our knowledge and our confidence that Jesus actually does love us is actually what empowers us to keep walking through furnaces. And you and I have way, way, way better evidence for the love of God to us than just a word of promised healing. We have a cross. And do you know on the cross, do you know even leading up to the cross, Jesus begged the Father in the Garden of Gethsemane, let this cup pass from me. And then on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Do you realize that in the comparison, in the contrast of this story, we have a father in this story who's begging Jesus to spare his son. And in the context of Jesus' death, we have a father who didn't spare his son, even though his son was asking for it. If there's any way this cup can pass from me, let it be. And in the great mystery of the Trinity and the great mystery of the cross, somehow in some way, the Father and the Son lost each other, as if to say this to you, in order for the Son to bear the punishment that you deserve, in order for Jesus to save and heal you, the Father lost his Son. And Jesus can now save you because the Father didn't save him on the cross. And the more you see Jesus and what he's done for you, the more you see that Jesus went into a furnace and didn't get out of it, the more you'll trust him when he asks you to walk through one. you'll find that he's the God who didn't spare his own son from death for you. And you'll find that no fire and no furnace can separate you from the love that God has for you in Christ Jesus. And here's what begins to happen. You will get on the other side of a furnace, and I know this sounds crazy, you will actually want Jesus more than you want him to just change things about your life. So this morning, would you lay down your demands of Jesus afresh? Put them at his feet and believe that he loves you enough to ask you to trust him. Walking by faith in trusting Jesus and his promises to you can heal you. Let's pray. Jesus, it's scary to walk in the wilderness lands, to walk in the furnace lands, the places where you have asked us to walk, and to trust you. To trust that you're not a liar, to trust that you're still good, to trust that you care deeply about us, to trust that you want to heal the places deep within us. So Jesus, meet us now. Loosen our grip on our demands of you, that we might walk by faith and cling to the promise that you indeed do love us very much. In your name, amen.